Good afternoon and welcome to Everyday Law, the show where we focus on important information that everyone needs to have at their disposal in order to protect their rights and to function in our society. We have the privilege today of having a guest to speak on a variety of topics, and that is Alan W. Steinhorn. Welcome, Mr. Steinhorn.
It's a pleasure to be here, Bob.
Mr. Steinhorn is a longtime Howard County resident who's been practicing law for more than 30 years. His offices are in Laurel, Maryland. As a brief background, Mr. Steinhorn attended the University of Maryland College Park and then graduated from the University of Baltimore School of Law and had the privilege of clerking for one of the finest judges that I've been before in the state of Maryland in my 35-year career, Judge Robert Mason of the Circuit Court for Prince George's County.
I'll second that about Judge Mason.
Thank you, Alan. I'd like to talk briefly about your professional undertakings and then focus on some practical applications of the law. The idea of everyday law is to help people who are not sophisticated about the law understand their rights and thus be in a position to be able to protect them. First of all, Alan, what is it that you do?
Well, I am a trial lawyer, and my job is to make sure that people's rights are enforced. And when circumstances arise where people need some sort of legal enforcement, and it goes into court, that's the kind of thing I do.
Now, does that involve more than one area of the law?
It does. Predominantly, I started my legal career after my clerkship doing injury and medical malpractice cases. But I also was in business before I went to law school, operated a business, and I do some business-related things. I also do consumer-related cases. And I also have a general practice because I've worked for two judges. I also interned in the Circuit Court for Montgomery County for Rosalind B. Bell, then a Circuit Court judge who was later appointed to the Court of Special Appeals. And throughout my career, I've handled a variety of cases that I thought would be interesting and where I thought I could help people.
It seems clear from what you've had to say that you do a host of different things in your professional life. Is there anything that you like doing the most?
Well, I like cases where somebody need someone to stand up and fight for them. I've done class action cases where I've filed lawsuits against for-profit trade schools that had deceived numerous students.
Now, when you say for-profit trade schools, are we talking about things like Trump University?
We are talking exactly like things like Trump University. I should say for-profit colleges. That's how I started. In 2007, I was asked to be lead counsel on a class action pending in the United States District Court for the District of Maryland involving a lawsuit against a very large private for-profit college system in the United States. I've done several of those cases, and I'm at a point in my career where I just want to do things that would help people.
I think that's a noble intention. Do you have something against such schools?
I have no problem with schools that honestly and fairly represent what they have to offer to their students. I do have problems with schools that are set up as businesses to make a profit and use what I might call snake oil salesman tactics to attract students to enroll in their universities by telling them that they will get rich quick if they go to their schools.
So periodically I see commercials on television about schools that are going to train you to do all manner of different things. How does an ordinary person distinguish between the ones that, as you say, have snake oil salesmen and ones that could provide a practical path to a lucrative career?
Well, it's very important that you research the schools. You can go to Better Business Bureau, you can Google them, and even put in the word complaints. But there's a valid reason and a good service for many trade schools and for-profit colleges. But you just have to be careful to make sure you're going to one that's going to give you what you're seeking. Trade schools in particular can offer students careers that they might not otherwise have. I know we're today at a college campus, but in addition to college education, there are other vocations that are extremely important in society. So these trade schools do perform a function. It's just important that you research them to make sure they don't have numerous complaints.
Now, to be clear, these schools are also overseen by, in this case, the state of Maryland, correct?
They are, but what we discovered, or what I discovered over the last several years of litigating these cases, is that the schools are mostly self-regulating and that they provide information to the state of Maryland through the Maryland Higher Education Commission. But the Maryland Higher Education Commission does not have any kind of enforcement or really oversight that would allow them to detect misrepresentations, deceptions made by the schools to entice students to enroll.
What sort of misrepresentations have you encountered in your career?
Well, part of the problem has to do with the federal loan program. Many years ago, Congress decided, and I think it was with good foresight, that there were certain communities that didn't have the ability to go to post-high school educational systems. So there were monies available for people from poorer neighborhoods, loans that they could get to go to certain for-profit schools. And there was abuse, and it was exposed, I think, in 2010 by the Attorney General's Office for the United States. They had conducted an investigation and discovered that many of the schools were misrepresenting graduation rates, employment rates, a variety of promises they made to the students. The students would go to an admissions interview and be told that if you enroll in our school, you'll make tons of money. Our graduates all make tons of money. And in a way, they're misled into enrolling into the school. Any school that promises you that you're going to make tons of money, I would be suspicious of that. But many students were told during these interviews that they would not have to pay for school because they were getting these federal loans. That was misleading, and it took advantage of a lot of people because if they didn't get jobs when they graduated from the programs, their student loans became due. And if they couldn't pay their student loans, many of these students...
Wait a second. I thought you told me they don't have to pay for it.
That's the deception.
So you're suggesting that representatives of the schools, in an enticement, talk to prospective students and tell them, you have nothing to worry about. You're not paying for this. The government is?
Well, what they tell them is that when they graduate, they're certain to get a job and they'll make so much money they can easily repay the loans.
I see.
And that is something that really can't be promised.
So how do you prove that such a thing took place?
It's very hard. You have to do extensive investigation, usually through the school's records, through the governmental agencies. The last case I tried, I learned that the school was claiming that several of the students I represented had obtained jobs upon graduation. In fact, only one of the six students that I represented in this last case had obtained a job after graduation. So we were surprised to discover that the Maryland higher education system and the Attorney General's office had reports from this particular school indicating that two of my students became fully employed after they graduated. That was false.
I see.
There's no way for the Maryland Higher Education Commission to know that reporting is false. So there is a potential for exaggeration and misrepresentation under this system.
I see. I would presume that the schools pride themselves on their job placement rates and that sort of thing and utilize that as a way to get students to enroll as well.
Well, when the United States government conducted its undercover investigation of for-profit trade schools around 2009-2010, one of the things they discovered was there was great misrepresentation as to graduation rates. Not only as to the graduation rates, but more importantly, the placement rates. So if a student is thinking about investing $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 in an education, one of the things that might be important to them would be how many of your students are placed in jobs after you graduate. And the school that has the highest placement percentage is probably going to attract the most students. So it is sometimes difficult to be sure that that placement rate is accurate. And what we've discovered in many of our lawsuits is those placement rates are inaccurate.
I see. So I surmise that the graduation rates also are of importance and that there must be instances where the schools, in an effort to show a high graduation rate, I don't know how to put this, help the students graduate, if you will?
Well, in the for-profit setting, and I do not want anyone listening to think this involves the colleges such as the one we're at now, or Howard County Community College, or University of Maryland, or Towson, or UMBC. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about for-profit colleges.
Okay.
And it is difficult to determine whether the placement rates are accurate.
Okay. So turning our attention to the opposite focus, what is the thing you least like doing in your professional life?
Well, I wish to a large degree people did not need my services.
Okay.
One of the things I find most unpleasant is we have a legal system set up, and in my particular field, in injury and malpractice, to compensate people that are harmed by another's negligence. And unfortunately, the insurance companies tend to take advantage of people, and I really wish they didn't need to call lawyers. But I've had many cases where people are exploited by insurance companies, they don't know their legal rights, and therefore they're not compensated as they should be under Maryland law. So I kind of have unpleasant feelings about insurance companies, and that dealing with them in many instances is one of the more unpleasant things I have to do. I worked for an insurance company as house counsel back in the late 1980s. In fact, I recall you did as well, Mr. Clark. And we learned how they work, and I'm sure that you, like I, tried as hard as we could to be honorable, respectful of others, and to do what was right. But we've reached a point, and this was 28, 29 years ago, I was doing that kind of work as house counsel for a major insurance company. We've reached a point in society where insurance companies are so desperate for profits that they have begun exploiting the victims of automobile accidents.
Okay. Can you give me a general idea of what sort of tactics or things occur that help you reach that conclusion?
Well, I recall when I was house counsel for this insurance company and I defended their insureds in court, I had a case that really confused me. I had reviewed all the paperwork. I was defending a lawsuit in the circuit court for Montgomery County. And it just seemed to me that our driver, our insured, was clearly at fault. I believe it was running a red light case. The individual was clearly hurt. And yet, when I received the lawsuit, there were no medical records in the file. There were no letters, no medical bills. So I called the claims representative and I said, I'm a little confused. I've got this case. It looks like we owe it. It looks like the person was hurt. And I'm just wondering, why did you deny this claim? Why do I have this as a lawsuit? And the claims representative was someone who was fairly new, and he told me, well, I didn't think the person was injured. And I said, well, you never looked at any medical records. I've got all the medical records. Can you tell me why you didn't think the person was injured? And the claims representative told me, because the first time I called him, I said, hi, how you doing? And he said, fine.
I see.
So therefore, he wrote in his notes, I don't think this person is hurt. Now, the problem for me is I'm the one in the courtroom in front of a jury looking at an X-ray of a cervical spine that is completely straight. And that's called cervical lordosis. And all of us have a curvature of our spine and our neck and our back. And when we're injured, if our muscles are strained and they're in spasm, your spine will straighten up. It is not something you can physically do. A person cannot fake it. And I had X-ray reports showing loss of the normal cervical lordosis. So the same day that this individual talked to the claims representative, his muscles were in extreme spasm. He was in incredible pain. The doctor's reports clearly stated all this, but this claims rep had never seen it because the person on the phone said, fine.
So the injured person was penalized for being routinely polite. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct.
Okay.
Perhaps one of the most egregious ones I saw, and I suppose I should be grateful that I got this legal fee, but I was contacted by a dental hygienist, and I also licensed in the District of Columbia. This occurred in D.C. I worked for a District of Columbia law firm where I practiced mostly in Maryland, but I did some of their D.C. cases. And it was a very lovely 25-year-old dental hygienist working at a nice dental practice on K Street. And she called me up and told me that someone had recommended I call her. And she wanted to hire me to compel, and I'll leave the insurance company's name out of it, to compel the insurance company to pay a $600 bill. And I asked her what had happened to her. And she explained that she was in a very bad car crash and was hurt and taken by ambulance to the hospital and was having neck pain. And she called the at-fault driver's insurance company and said, what should I do? I've never been in an accident before. And the person said, well, we're clearly at fault. We're really sorry, and we'll pay for your medical bills. And the young lady said, I don't have a doctor. So this insurance company was so helpful, they sent her to their doctor. And lo and behold, their doctor wanted to order an MRI scan, which is an expensive test. At the time, it was $600, but in today's dollars, you might pay $800 to $1,000 for an MRI scan. She went to the MRI scan, had it taken, and lo and behold, it showed a herniated disc in her neck, which is a very serious injury that can lead to surgery.
Now, just to be clear, was there anything that made it obvious that this herniated disc was the result of her personal injury incident, or how did that?
Well, the young lady hadn't seen a doctor in over 7 years.
Okay.
And the nature of her injury caused her to have radiating pain shooting down her arm, and it was intense pain in her neck and her arm. It was the kind of pain that was interfering with her job.
Okay.
So one would imagine that if she had this injury before the car accident, she probably would have known it. She probably would have sought medical care. There would have been an X-ray. There would have been an MRI scan. There would have been a complaint to someone.
Okay.
And there was none.
So it was medically obvious then?
Clearly obvious.
Okay.
And in fact, it was the insurance company's doctor that ordered that test.
Now, just to focus on something as a practical matter for everyday law, Are there doctors that fall into different camps, insurance company doctor versus injured person's doctor? How does that all work?
There are doctors that tend to favor insurance companies. And if you're cynical, like most lawyers I've met that have done this for three decades, you're going to believe that there are doctors that are going to give opinions that favor the insurance companies, and gosh darn, I'll be cynical, because they get paid to do it.
Okay. What kind of money are we talking about?
Well, I'm aware of at least one orthopedic surgeon that was making between $1 million and $2 million a year solely doing examinations of patients for insurance companies. In fact, he was so good at it that they flew him from the East Coast, he was a local doctor here, to the West Coast for 2 days a week. They paid for his airfare, they paid for his hotel rooms, nice hotels, all his meals, so that he could do 20 to 30 examinations every day.
Oh, my Lord.
Then he would write reports, and he would get about $600 to $800 per report. So if he did 20 in a day, he'd be getting $12,000 to $14,000 a day, $25,000 a week. What is that times 52? You math majors out there, can you do that for me?
Over $700,000.
It's a lot of money. A lot of money. And that was just for those 2 days a week. So if he were to find that people were hurt badly, it's likely they would not continue hiring him.
I see.
So you could say it's a coincidence that the people he examines are never hurt. Or you could say, is there a monetary incentive for him to say people are not hurt? I don't wish to impugn this gentleman's integrity, but we have seen doctors in our practice who are the same doctors over and over and over again who are examining patients for insurance companies, and it's the same doctors.
It's interesting because one would think if testifying for the insurance companies was so lucrative that all doctors would want a piece of that.
You know, I guess this would be something that would make me less cynical. No, not every doctor wants to do that.
Okay.
It is somebody who wants the financial rewards associated with it, but not all doctors are like that. In fact, I would suggest to you that most of the doctors that we deal with that are treating our patients don't want to be involved in the legal system.
Okay. And why is that?
Because anytime they go into court, the insurance company lawyers will question them in a way that attacks their integrity and attacks their medical abilities, and it's very unpleasant. But that is the nature of our legal system. It's an adversary system. We're not really searching for the truth, I don't believe, in some of these cases. I think we're just trying to advocate each side's position as best as we can. I would love to think that it's a search for the truth. Okay. And the longer I've done this, again, the more cynical I've gotten. But you will see, like in the criminal setting, and I do a little bit of criminal work, you will see prosecutors who truly are dedicated to a search for the truth and a search for justice. And then every so often you will see prosecutors who are really more interested in professional advancement, and professional advancement occurs with convictions. I prosecuted early in my career for a very short period of time, and I felt that my role was to achieve justice, to do what was right. And if I found a case where I could get a conviction, but I thought that, and this happened once, where I thought that the evidence was being altered or misrepresented, I dismissed the case. And that occurred once in, that was in the district court in Baltimore City. It was a misdemeanor case. I don't want to say, I will say this, almost all police officers are honorable and have integrity. They really try and do what's best. They really try and do justice for everyone, to protect everyone. We owe a debt of gratitude to all police. But if you have just one bad police officer in a department, it can taint that entire department. So early in my career, I was prosecuting a theft case. It was a breaking and entering on a boat in Baltimore's Inner Harbor. Being a young attorney, not really sure actually what I was supposed to do in every case. In fact, if I may clarify, this was my senior year in law school. And
okay.
It was pursuant to one of Maryland's rules, I think it was Rule 16, that permitted law students to participate in legal proceedings in a courtroom under the supervision of another attorney.
So you had not at that point in time taken and passed a bar exam, right?
I had not.
Okay.
But the reason I was asked to do this is I had already interned for a circuit court judge, and not meaning to toot my horn, I had been selected by my law school to participate in a national trial competition of 83 law schools. And I was the only student, along with Carmela Leone, if you're out there, love to hear from you. Carmela and I were selected by our school to represent the University of Baltimore School of Law, and we were the only student team to go undefeated in the competitions. We won our regionals, and we went to the national competition.
Wow.
So the professor that was aware of this suggested that I go into court my senior year. So I was prosecuting in the district court in the Central District, which was the busiest courthouse in the state of Maryland. This was back when the block was somewhat of a larger area, and it was an extremely busy courthouse, but there was a breaking and entering on a boat in the Inner Harbor. I asked the supervising attorney exactly what I needed to do to try the case. She explained the outline to me, and I went to interview the police officer witness. And the first question was the gate to the boat locked or unlocked? And his answer to me was, what should it be? And I was a little confused.
Wait a minute. You're saying the police officer was asking you about a crucial fact, and he really didn't know either way, and he wanted to portray it in the most advantageous way?
He knew whether it was locked or unlocked.
Okay.
He wanted to know what answer would be most likely to convict the defendant.
Oh, my Lord.
So this perturbed me, to put it mildly, and I immediately stopped the interview and said, Officer, could you give me a minute? Because I had never encountered anything like this. I just knew that I couldn't present this witness.
Sure.
Have a clear conscience, and I felt that my role as a prosecutor wouldn't permit it. Fortunately, my instinct was correct, and I went to the supervising attorney, and she said to me, go to the defense lawyer, ask him if his client wishes to enter into plea negotiation. And of course, if his client was guilty and concerned about a conviction, he would probably want to enter into a plea agreement. And I said, what if he doesn't want to enter into a plea agreement? And she said, well, you know what you have to do, dismiss the case. So I asked the attorney if he wanted to enter a plea agreement. He said his client did not, and we dismissed the case.
So I have some, for lack of a better term, ethical qualms about the person supervising you kind of using the lack of information as a way to maybe get a plea agreement out of this guy.
The way it was presented was, does your client wish to plea?
Okay.
It was not any encouragement, and I was not permitted to tell the defendant's attorney that we had a strong case. If they asked me if we had a strong case, I was not to say anything misleading, but if he wanted to plead guilty, he was given an opportunity. If it would help his conscience, if it would be something he wanted to do, he was asked.
I understand that.
But it was a very uncomfortable moment. I will mention to you that I later discussed this with the judge that I clerked for, and he said he would not have even gone so far as to ask if the defendant wished to plea, that he would have simply dismissed the case and told the officer that he would never try a case again on his behalf if he ever suggested anything other than the absolute truth. And I found that to be a preferable way to resolve it. But the defendant did not wish to plead guilty. He did not need to clear his conscience. So the case was dismissed. I think that many lawyers that do criminal defense work will tell you similar stories, although they may not have had it from the perspective that I did. But there are instances where technology has shown that officers are not always truthful. And again, I want to be very clear, 99.9% of all officers are there doing their every bit to try and help us, try to protect us. It is not a job that I would do and sleep well at night. It's a dangerous job, and I don't want anyone to think that I'm being critical of the police in general. Every profession has a bad apple or two. My own profession does. They make me look bad. They make all the lawyers look bad, just like a bad cop will make other cops look bad.
So let's try and derive some practical suggestions for our listening audience from your discussions about things. First of all, let's go back to the doctors that seem to fall into different categories. How do you avoid going to the insurance doctor who will undermine your case if you're injured in a car crash?
That's a good question. It's very difficult to know. And in fact, many of these doctors who are treating physicians, if you don't have a legal case, many of them are very good doctors. If you do have a legal case, they may not be as willing to promote your injuries before a jury, but they will do it. However, many of the doctors that I've encountered that do testify on behalf of insurance companies seem to have one common thread, and that is they don't believe people get hurt that badly.
Okay.
So in some instances, I've seen patients that are poorly treated because the doctors have a certain standard that they use. And I think part of it is that they testify in court. One example, a soft tissue injury, a case where you've injured your neck muscles in a car accident. A hyperflexion extension injury is what it would
be. So a soft tissue is not like a broken bone or the herniated disc you referred to earlier, correct?
Well, the muscles of the body are the soft tissues. although the discs that are between the vertebrae of our spine are soft. They won't show up well on x-rays the way bones will. I'm referring to what insurance companies refer to as whiplash injuries.
Okay.
And in fact, there's been a campaign over the last 20 or 30 years to publicize to the American public that whiplash injuries are exaggerated. They're not real.
And whose campaign is this exactly?
Well, I'll give you the first time I encountered it. I was driving to work, and I heard on the radio an advertisement for Aetna. And the advertisement—
Big insurance giant.
Went something like this. At Aetna, we fight insurance fraud. We don't let those criminals take advantage of our insurance.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, who buys insurance by saying, Aetna, yeah, they fight insurance fraud. That's who I want. I don't think so. And that was part of a campaign back in the 1980s and 90s, and it's still going on today. And this is political, but there are people that have benefits. There are companies that get benefits by not paying insurance claims.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can convince the public, and by the way, the public is also your jury, if they can convince the public that there's abuses in the field of injury law, that people are exaggerating and faking their injuries, and that it's causing our insurance premiums to go up, if they get people to have that mindset, then when they go into court, they'll disregard the judge's instructions that they are to base the case on the evidence only. They're not supposed to make any presumptions from outside the realm of the courtroom. But if they go into the jury room thinking these people have reasons to exaggerate, they won't give you a fair shake.
I understand. So let's turn to a somewhat broader concept, and that is, what is your favorite single thing about the law?
You know, I did a little bit of reading before I came in today, and I would say that one of my favorite things, our country is based on a constitution that is perhaps the greatest document ever written of any governing society, and I get to enforce the constitution occasionally.
In your capacity as an attorney or in your capacity as a private citizen or both?
In my capacity as an attorney, and there are cases that we occasionally see that involve violations of the constitution. And the Constitution gives the greatest rights to the American citizens of any document in the world that I'm aware of. There are a lot of things that make America great. I am the son of an immigrant who is also a refugee. I am the grandson of Austrian immigrants. And I was raised with a great sense of patriotism, and my parents made very clear to me the differences between communist countries, third world countries, countries run by dictators, and our country.
Okay.
And I was told when I was a little child that my country would give me the right to accomplish whatever I set out to do if I worked hard enough. And I found that to be true. Our press is the fourth rail of our government. We have Congress, we have the judicial branch, we have the executive branch. But the very First Amendment that was written was the freedom of speech. That's the first thing that our founding fathers thought was important. And without a free press, government abuses would go unreported. The things that our press have revealed has been very important to the functioning of our free democratic society, and they keep government officials in check. Even though the media has been under attack lately by the current administration, I can't underestimate the importance that they fill in our society in keeping our government honest.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Steinhorn. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today. This is Everyday Law.